I'm Mindy.
And I'm Darren, and we are the Rants Macabre, a part of the Fangoria Podcast Network. For more information about the network, including other programs, how to follow the show, and find past episodes of the Rants Macabre, please visit fangoria.com.
On this episode, Darren and I had the opportunity to sit with writer and director Corin Hardy. He's the writer-director of The Hollow that's coming out November 6th, and we got to, number one, see a screener, which is always exciting for me. I love seeing things before other people, and I love it even more when I actually enjoy watching it. So this was really fun.
Yeah, and he was very cool to talk to.
Yeah, it was really cool talking to him, and we got to see some of his sketch books and his drawings, which is amazing. Like, he's an amazing artist, visual artist.
Really creative guy across the board. And sort of before meeting him and sort of doing the due diligence, I looked at his animation work, and we talked about that mm-hmm. it was a 5-year labor of love, the stop motion animation.
Which, didn't that surprise you? I mean, not because 5 years? I mean, I understand that stop animation takes some time, but like, can you imagine just like sitting with your heart and soul 5 years? It's a crazy labor of love.
I don't have the patience for that. I mean, podcasting thankfully is very, well, it's quite immediate. All right, so let's jump in. So the good news is The Hollow is good, and it's got a number of different things at play, and mm-hmm. Corin he's clearly a genre obsessive, and he talks very freely about like the specific influences that went into making this mm-hmm. movie, and he comes from like a sculpting artistic background. We talked about his notebook. So designing the creatures himself and working with teams, like, it was all a labor of love. Every inch of this movie is him through and through. But why don't we talk about the synopsis a little bit?
Okay. Here's the basic premise of The Hollow. After an environmental surveyor moves his family to a remote mill house in Ireland, he finds an ancient evil in the woods. Despite warnings from the locals, they stay and struggle to survive with demonic creatures living in the woods.
Yeah, it's funny. We talked to Corin about and it's a reoccurring thought on this podcast, but like, when you enter a strange land that has locals and those mm-hmm. locals warn you, you should probably listen. You should probably listen for your own good.
Number one, they're always like a closed off, weird local person. You know, it's like a local yokel, but they really kind of know what they're talking about, and maybe you should always listen to them.
Yeah, but city folk are just like, you simple people.
I know better than you, who's lived here forever.
And in this case, he's a man of science, so on a number of levels, he should have known better. There were several things where he was asking for it.
It's true.
So the movie starts with him carrying a baby in the woods.
Yeah. There's enough trees to keep daddy busy till you're all grown up.
And it's kind of, you know, it's a very sweet image, sort of a guy doing his job with his son on his back. And his kid is like 6 months old.
Yeah.
And he is seemingly taking samples off trees, but there's a very quick reveal that like he's not just taking samples, but he's marking these trees for demolition.
Mm-hmm.
And so that like sours you quickly. Like it's the first surprise of the movie where like, I wanted to like this guy, but he's working
he's
for the
evil.
Man.
But he's not being bad. I mean, he's taking out in what he thinks is trees infected with this a mold. That's why he's marking them.
I didn't catch on to that.
It's not that he's just like being a dick and cutting everything down. Like, he's doing it because these trees are sick.
I didn't realize that. Yeah. That's all right. Well, that I'm less angry at him then.
Okay. But, no, he's not just being a jerk.
So cut to his wife at the house doing work, and she is specifically like demilitarizing the home by taking off the bars from the windows. Like, it kind of looks like a prison, and she's, you know, wants to
not live in an iron prison.
Make
sure.
It more of a home. And that's when the locals pop up, and there's a relationship in place where the locals don't like them there.
He's in the forest again, is he? He's trespassing.
It's his job, Mr. Donnelly.
It's dangerous for him and the little one.
I'm sorry. I'll make sure my husband stops by your farm first thing tomorrow.
Tonight. He comes to see me tonight.
It's rude in some ways what he's expecting his wife to do, actually. Because,
in terms of dealing with the locals?
Yeah, it's like, you deal with the violent, crazy locals that hate us.
So the husband comes home, and you know what? Actually, there's a brief moment of jump scare. There aren't too many. The movie is not indulgent in that way.
No, but the few that are for jump scares are
pretty effective.
Yeah, you'll jump out of your seat.
Yeah. So while he's in the woods, he encounters, well, I guess the sick trees are infected with cordyceps fungus. And for nature nerds, you might have come across these in nature specials that dealt with infections for like bullet ants that would get this fungus in them. The fungus would grow and overtake the brain of the bullet ant and eventually sprout out of its head and sort of drive it around like an ATV.
Right.
Zombie ants.
Which is really sad, though. You feel actually bad for...
Yeah. It's always funny when they describe it as like, well, these ants were behaving in a very un-ant-like way. Like, they've gotten mad.
Someone's wearing
fungus.
An ant body.
So the terrifying dynamic is that this fungus has jumped species. He comes across a deer.
Don't tell mom.
You know, for nature nerds, you kind of recognize that as like, well, that's something to be terrified of.
Right.
And leave that sample where it is and go home.
Don't touch that dead deer. Get your dog. Get your baby. Get the fuck out of there.
Yeah.
He should go back to England.
Hazmat suit. Yes. The safe island.
The safe island.
In different interviews, Corinne had talked about location scouting and that they actually used three different woods to sort of feature as this one hallow in the film. So it does lend to like a very dynamic environment outside of their estate. So in the opening, that's just one glimpse. And then, you know, he ventures out again. And, you know, as the story unfolds, you get a look at different, like they're almost fantastical. Some of the settings, like
yeah,
it looks
some
like
of it's beautiful. I mean, that was one of the first things
stuff.
When I started watching it, you know, you see the countryside and you see, you know, the woods and it's very beautiful film, you know.
Yeah. Ireland's gorgeous to film. So like it's the movie's great looking and Corinne is clearly like an aesthetics guy. So, you know, for a first-time feature-length film directorial debut, he knocked that much out of the park. And if anything, if I've got complaints about the movie, is he might have had the creatures on camera a bit too much.
I would agree with that.
Maintaining the mystery of them. And they are very unique. All these characters, and there's a couple, and they all sort of play towards Irish folklore. And so in the interview, we talk about sound design and how these are all different characters and they were sort of treated like it from, you know, aesthetics to audio qualities.
They believe that the forest that you're trampling on belongs to the Hollow.
The Hollow.
The good people. Fairies. Banshees. Baby stealers. You're not a fae with your Irish folklore, are you, Mr. Hitchens? Conquered people, forever in hiding, driven from their sacred lands by man with iron and fire.
So he's got these great characters, and I think the temptation is to like get your money's worth and really have them on camera. And so they are on camera, you know, every once in a while they're, you know, for my taste, they're lit a little too much, maybe. And they
I
show
could definitely
off
agree
a
with
too
that.
Much.
Because I'm a person who barely likes to see.
Yeah.
A monster, because I'm a person who looks in the corners, always looking in the corners for something that's maybe like sneaking around. So I can totally agree with that. But I also understand why he wanted to show them because
sure.
They're such individuals as well as this big group dynamic.
Even their movements are unique. And I guess that's something that's hard to sort of show without like giving them center stage where like you're trying to, you know, make an example of this woodland creature that doesn't move like people do. And he talked about how they had like different athletes and dancers and performers sort of, you know, moving in this alien way.
One of my favorite visuals from the movie is the attic scene, which is something when we were talking to Corinne, we got to see in his sketchbook, the exact scene sketched out. And
that was
really cool because that's one of those mise-en-scène kind of things where, you know, you could see that as a panel in a comic book because it's just excellent. It's the mom is upstairs with the baby and the creatures are trying to get to her.
The husband's trying to start the generator and like the, you know, side barn to the house. So these creatures, the only thing keeping them away is light. And so the house is completely dark and she's trapped in the attic when that hand bursts through. Like first decays the door.
Yeah, that's a very really, cool effect.
Organic, like, yeah.
It's like going through the wood, kind of.
Yeah. And so when that hand comes through and she's trying to hold the door closed while this hand is reaching further up. And yeah.
And it's, yeah, trying to poke her in the eye.
But yeah, no, that it was not just like an incredibly tense scene. And it also demonstrated.
And it's long, too. That is a long scene.
And it was one of these perfect scenarios where he had both like the physical, practical fear, then grown and exaggerated by CG.
Mm-hmm.
But it works. It's in the style of like the way Guillermo del Toro does a combination of practical and post CG work that it was, you know, it was terrifying, but really pretty.
Yeah. I mean, what I really couldn't believe was the length of that scene, but it never feels too much.
Yeah. Because it does ramp up.
Yeah. The tension grows when you think it can't be any more tense in that scene than it does. It kicks it up the next notch.
Yeah. In working up to the interview and seeing the movie, I watched the trailer and there is a brilliant visual of the like long form scythe.
Mm-hmm.
A sickle is small, right?
A sickle is little one on the Russian flag.
Okay, so a scythe is like what death carries.
Yes, that's what I would
think.
Across
the river Styx. Yeah. So when the main character both needs a weapon and a means of illuminating the room, makes a torch out of the scythe and sets it on fire. And so it's one of the coolest visuals and it gets put to some pretty effective use.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, it's a gorgeous image. It's actually on, there's a motion trailer now and it's part of one of the movie posters that they made for it as well. We're going to leave it there in terms of story specific details, but I will say it was very cool to see in form a number of like pieces of Irish mythology and folklore.
Right.
And you know, what do I know? Aside from leprechauns and banshees and even banshees, I don't have a great sense of like what the visuals meant.
Mostly
to be.
I think of the comic books. If I think of Banshee, you know,
a mutant who flies by the use of his own voice.
Yeah. Why not?
Well, I actually know it from Hellboy comics. There's I think it's the Chains Coffin collected graphic novels that goes into two different pieces of Irish mythology, one being the Changeling and the other one being Iron Shoes. And
which you find iron and changelings in lots of mythology.
Yeah.
You find it even in trolls.
It seems like most supernatural beings hate iron.
Everyone hates iron. Everyone wants to switch your baby out for another baby. Which I found out that fairies, the reason that they a lot of times would do this changeling, would switch out, is because if you're a really old fairy, your fairy group will like switch you out for a baby. So then these humans have to take care of you. And that's like fairy retirement.
Wow.
You become like this baby and they raise you and love you. But they don't know that you're not their kid. And then the fairies raise your kid, I guess.
I guess if not.
Or something.
Eat it?
I don't think they eat the baby. That's theirs now.
Okay.
But yeah, it's like fairy retirement. Like, hey, grandma, you're a really old fairy. Go pretend to be a baby and live with these humans. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
That's very cool.
Because I was like, why would you want to swap out babies?
Yeah, you kind of assume that they're, going to eat it or use it for some magical, devious purpose. But yeah.
Fairy retirement.
The woodland creatures in the movie, when we think fairies, we think Tinkerbell and like Disney-fied nymphs and stuff like that. But like going back to like Grimm tales, all these like folklore-based stories, like they're far grittier than the Disney versions that we grew up with.
And Corinne actually talks about that a little bit when we talk with him. And I kind of actually relate to that because I grew up, my grandmother would tell me Eastern European fairy tales, which are terrifying monster stories. So like you're like 3 years old and you know about Baba Yaga, you know, it's those kind of things. Like this is terrifying, but you know, that's how you grow up. And so I kind of thought that was really interesting to think about fairy tales in a very different way than America thinks about them.
You don't listen. You think I'm crazy?
We're here with Corinne Hardy, the writer-director of The Hallow. And so Saturday night was Halloween. You had a screening here in Manhattan. Watching it in a crowd on Halloween must have been some next-level shit.
It was next-level shit, for sure. It was, it's almost like a dream come true to finally have, my debut movie called The Hallow come to New York. I'd never been to New York before and have it screened on Halloween.
So this was your first time here?
Yeah, it's my first time here all this time. I've been over to the States, but always, for some reason, never New York. So I think it was destiny. I had to wait till I made a horror movie.
Nice.
No, but it was incredible. And it was great, really nice screening at the Lincoln Center.
Great.
I'd imagine it's a lot of fun for people. The crowd reaction, I mean, it's a lot different than watching a screener on your computer.
Oh, yeah.
So there are a couple different types of horror at play in The Hallow. There's sort of contagion, body horror elements, and ancient evil monster, and maybe with a touch of like Straw Dogs or Pumpkinhead.
Sure. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about your influences going into the movie?
Yeah. Those are certainly some of them. I mean, I'm a big fan of what I call that sort of 70s and 80s kind of golden age of horror movies, to me anyway, and films like The Exorcist and The Thing and The Evil Dead, Alien,
sure.
The Fly. There's something about them which, I grew up on. I saw King Kong when I was a kid, and it really kind of terrified me, but then really also moved me. And as I grew up, I kind of had this appreciation of monsters and loved this other world that you could kind of collide with our world. So it was a case of trying to, when I got the chance to make my first film, I had a number of ideas, and they were all sort of based in this idea of doing a kind of grounded in reality movie, sort of harking back to that 70s period, something sort of cinematic, but something that was real. And I'd looked to sort of fairy mythology and folklore as a way of trying to explore a new spin on a creature. And there's so much kind of great mythology. It was a case of, pulling that into our reality. So I was using a film like Straw Dogs and Pan's Labyrinth as a kind of a combination of what this film could be like.
There's a lot of stuff that you said I want to jump on, but let's speak specifically. So Irish mythology is generally not known by most Americans, and so
we know about banshees, but that's about it, right?
The surface level. Right. I mean, I've read a couple pieces like in Hellboy. He likes to like dig into sort of cultural idiosyncrasies. I'm curious, and I guess in other interviews you've talked about Irish mythology sort of making its way to you as a kid. Were there particular things that sort of?
I think to begin with, it was not even Irish. It was just sort of actually being read fairy tales and looking at picture books that these European ones that I had that were really kind of quite creepy, but they captured my imagination. There was the sort of imagery of creatures in forests and witches, and then. When I decided on this idea of like a kind of fairy tale grounded in reality, the closest sort of and most potent mythology to me growing up in England was Ireland. I mean, that exists also in Scotland and Cornwall, but Ireland feels like the sort of true home to me. So researching Irish mythology is never ending, and is much. I like this idea of taking in making a horror movie and looking for a new creature effectively. There's so many ideas that haven't been sort of explored yet. I was sort of drawing from them and trying to think what could translate visually and viscerally. And
and there's a number of things in the movie that I hadn't seen before. And I love the idea of the cordyceps, the fungus.
Yeah.
As a sort of, I get nerdy about science meeting folklore.
Well, that was really important because, again, I, as much as I love a good fantasy movie, what we know of fairy tales and maybe, you know, you associate more over here is sort of Tinkerbell and fantasy fairy movies. And yet the, you know, a bit like the sort of Santa Claus, the origins of that, which we're going to see in Krampus sort of thing. You know, there's a much darker world. So I wanted to get rid of ideas of Tinkerbell and show you kind of like there's a much more manipulative, devious and devastating kind of fairy. And I was interested to sort of see what it might be like for a family or like you or me to experience what it'd be like to encounter one or a group in an isolated place. And have to sort of like embrace the folkloric logic found in fairy tales as like warnings and preventions.
Yeah.
I can't remember if I answered your question then or not.
No, that was great. Yeah. I was thinking on that note, the dynamic.
Oh, the science of nature, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, so in early on, we're introduced to the main character, Joseph.
Joseph Moore, yeah.
Who's an environmental surveyor and discovers a fungus that is familiar enough in terms of like its effect on insects. And it seems like every insect has its own unique kind of fungus that will turn it into a zombie, so to speak.
Yeah.
But this one is jump species, and that's kind of a terrifying prospect.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I came across this idea of cordyceps on an English science and nature show with David Attenborough.
I think they probably dubbed it in American for us.
Right, right.
Yeah, but I've seen the same one.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, like most nature shows, there's just tons of ideas that you're like, oh my God, that goes on in these like micro worlds or far-reaching jungles, and they're far more kind of like crazy ideas than what we can dream up. But I think it was a case of trying to explore a mythology and work out ways it could kind of tie in with science and nature so that there's two sort of ideas going on, and it was a case of walking this fine line between, you know, like a fantasy, which if it got too fantastical, it would pull you out of the movie and stop it from becoming scary. I didn't want to do like a gothic fairy tale. I want it to be like a reality drama that kind of draws on and becomes a fairy tale gradually.
Yeah.
Now, the design of the creatures, which it's creatures in different stages as we kind of go through the movie. Did you do some of the sketching or where did...
We're staring at a notebook.
Yeah. And I mean, so I wanted to know where you kind of got the ideas and what you kind of drew from for your sketches.
Corn's notebook has some familiar faces from the movie.
So I know that they can't see this, but like you can welcome to have a little look. And these are sketchbooks that I carry around with me at all times and enjoy. I've always enjoyed just trying to visualize ideas that I'm working on. And in terms of the Hallow, for years before the production, I was sort of like, well, what are these creatures? What are these fairies going to look like?
Mm-hmm.
So I, and then in doing that, knowing that I was going to have to visualize them on film, it was really important to be able to design them in a way that could be executed to a certain level that wouldn't let you down. I wanted it to feel satisfying, you know, as a creature lover and a monster lover. I wanted to see them, you know, the right sort of amount, but you know, try and put something on screen that would be memorable and terrifying, hopefully. And
they looked great. They looked awesome. And I think when we very first see them, you don't know exactly what you're seeing.
Great.
And I think that was an excellent non-kind of reveal. You're like, what is crawling around? This is, I really liked it.
The fear of the unknown is always the greatest fear. So with a horror movie, you're always like going to get to that point where you either reveal or, I mean, I think when you don't reveal at all, it's like, to me, unsatisfying, and yet you don't want to reveal.
You put so much work into these costumes, you want to put them on camera.
So that was part of the challenge of the movie, was to try and create something that would sustain the tension and imagination, and then when it actually reveals itself, you know, I was so close to the movie by the time I'd finished, I didn't know whether I'd created something that wasn't scary in the end, and I was a bit, like, worried that, you know, I spent all this time making a horror movie and it wasn't scary, but people have kind of unanimously found it kind of terrifying, which is quite exciting.
Yeah, no, I thought there was some really, really good scares that I watched with my husband, and it actually had him like jumping off the couch. So that was kind of nice. I like that anytime.
You get nerves of steel.
Exactly. Not me. Not me. No, I jump at everything.
That's cool.
Well, speaking to there's a reality to the costumes and the makeup, and from what I understand, like the majority of it was done practical, was done for the actors to be on camera wearing you know different apparatus, and then it was sort of followed up in post to sort of tweak and change. Could you talk about that process in terms of like the design will take you to a certain point for what's on camera?
Yeah, I mean, again, it stems from the love of those movies, and like I said, when I was a kid, I was, you know, living in the south of England. I'd come up pilgrimage. I'd make pilgrimages to London to buy Fangoria magazine, and I'd sit and, you know, we would collect them, me and my good friend David Lupton, who's the illustrator of the book In the Hallow, and we would, as 12-year-olds, 11-year-olds, we would sit, like, pouring through Fangoria, looking at these, you know, Rick Baker's latest effects, or Rob Bottin, or Stan Winston, or Dick Smith, and these how-to guides, and do our own versions. So very, like, in summers, we would get together with a group of friends and make our own monster movies and try out effects techniques. So I guess it comes from the love of that, but at the same time, I wouldn't want to do something for nostalgic reasons if it wasn't effective. But I did try and say, look, everyone, we're going to do this as practically as possible. You know, we're gonna use old school techniques and prosthetic makeup and animatronics and man in suit, and but then we've got this ability now to use visual effects and CGI, and so it was a sort of a gamble in a sense. But then it's worked in the past when we didn't have CGI and visual effects, so why shouldn't it work now? And it, for me anyway, it was also much more fun and effective to work that way, and be able to try and create illusion mixing techniques so you can't pin it down, which again helps create fear. If you see something and you're like, wow, that's a good effect, that's a CG gollet, you know, or something. It's sort of like it can be, obviously it's incredible what we can do, but I think the minute CG becomes apparent, I don't think it's kind of immersively
connected. Start thinking about the effect itself rather than the point of what it was trying to
do. I think it's become a crutch kind of today in modern horror, is really overusing CG.
It's far easier also sort of to not take risks and therefore fix things afterwards. I think for everyone concerned, it's less of a risk than like, because, you know, when you show someone something, you're kind of putting yourself on the line and going, this is it.
Right.
And then people all have like an opinion. Whereas if you don't have that and, you know, you do it in post, it's kind of something that can keep being worked on afterwards. But for me anyway, on an independent sort of low budget horror movie, it was really key in trying to pre-imagine everything, meticulously have it ready for shooting in camera. You know, you can see some of this.
Yeah,
as
I think that was one of my favorite moments where it continues to grow at her.
Through the attic door. And that was excellent.
This is some designs, some storyboards, concept art, and then this is making it all, sculpting it, animatronics, silicone rubber, puppets, and then taking it the next stage into mocking up forms with the creature performers and involving puppet limbs and animatronic faces. And so when you could start to see that again, you're just like, oh, right, okay, we got it, you know, we can see how it's going to work. They're on the floor, they're already a bit creepy the way they're moving around, and we haven't got any lighting or
as the director then what do you, if someone, one of your people who's moving for the monster, where do you say no, that imaginary mythological creature would never move like that? Like, where do you come from that way?
It sounds crazy, but you just have an instinct of what we know. So I mean, obviously some things just come great. This is also why I love doing it for real, because you get happy accidents all the time when someone does something or something fails or something breaks, and you're actually like, hang on, that's quite cool. Or, you know, you see a certain movement or a certain look. So, but we workshopped, we auditioned a number of performers, you know, people who did mountaineering, ballet, contortionists, parkour, animal specialist movements. Because if you look at any kind of classic monster movie, the person playing the creature there's a reason why it's memorable, because they brought it to life in such a way, whether it's like, you know, the guy who played Alien and Predator, or Doug Jones, who does a lot of Guillermo's films. They're very unique people, and both physically they have attributes, but they can also, you know, you can't just stick someone in a rubber suit and go like, right, you know, be a monster, be scary. Yeah. So we workshopped them, got them to become the Hallow through a series of experiments, like to looking at insect movements, working with a guy called Peter Elliott, who actually was the lead ape in the original Greystoke Tarzan movie, who's kind of like an Andy Serkis character, mm-hmm. who's very experienced in creature and animal performance, and you know, both the sounds, the mentality, the movement. So that at least, again, in terms of doing a movie for real, turning up on set and being able to get them straight into their kind of characters mm-hmm. was really important, because they were crawling around forests 4 a.m. in Ireland in the rain, not being able to see, hear or breathe most of the time.
You mentioned the sound. The sound design was so specific and varied. There's so many different characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, it probably helped that I was watching and listening on with headphones. Uh-huh. So it was immediate. What was the sound design process like, sort of giving every different character something different?
Well, thanks for asking. It was, again, I mean, all aspects of the filmmaking, from the cinematography to the editing to the effects, I was trying to really go for it with, you know, as much creative, to create the world that you're in, to try and immerse you in it, and to choose people who are very talented and passionate people, trying to hit the highest level we could, really, even in this. So Steve Flanagan, who's an Irish sound designer at Ardmore Sound, which is a really great old, huge old studio in Ireland. It was one of the biggest sound stages in Europe. And it was as practical and organic as possible. So we had, they did a lot of, you know, the foley and everything. But when it came to the creatures themselves, same sort of thing. You know, I kind of cast and also roped in the help of some friends, because when it came down to it, it was, rather than trying to create the sounds from existing, you know, in a lion or something, we went into a studio and experimented with our vocal cords and gargling milk and, you know, kind of coming up with the sound of the Hallow based on what might have happened to you. I mean, without giving away too much of what happens in the movie, the sort of deterioration and transformation that's occurring, and how old the things could be, and what, you know, there was a sense of communication between them. So we had a lot of fun doing it, and I found, you know, someone, a girl who I knew was able to do the most high-piercing kind of scream that was, like, inhuman when she did it. She's not an actress, but it was like, whoa. So, you know, we had a lot of fun experimenting.
Yeah, the sound goes a long way mm-hmm. in terrorizing the viewer, I thought.
Great. No, I mean, it is literally 50% of what you experience is the sound, and you can do a great movie, but if you don't have that world, so Steve really created this extended world of, you know, what's out there.
Now, you're a music video guy, and in music videos, you know, the actors rarely hear the songs, but you were using a lot of diegetic music in this, and so I wondered when you were deciding, the actor can hear this music, and then when to rely on the scoring of the music that was added.
I mean, I did play music on set sometimes. Sometimes the actors would listen to it before a take just to get themselves into it. That said, James Gosling was the composer who did a fantastic job. He was only really able to start working towards the end of it. So sometimes I'd be playing mood music, or like, I think I played some Deftones at one point, really, really loud, when they were like having the car sequence, when they were losing control, just to get the energy up. And, like, you know, constantly you're trying to think of ways to keep everyone energized and on their toes. And with a horror movie, especially when it's quite urgent, it takes place over one night. Actually, shooting roughly one night over the period of 30 days or 3 weeks of nights, the continuity of emotional tone is really quite hard to maintain, because you're shooting it out of sequence. You can't just have everyone scream all the time. You have to have, like, you know, they need to know exactly what headspace they're in. So music did help to sort of sometimes calm or set a tone, or, you know, talk about where they were, and other times to just, like, blast it. I'd be also sometimes shrieking at them or hitting things and, you know, shouting and, you know... whatever it takes, you know.
Yeah, it's funny. We're working on an episode. It is a two-part, but it's the Aliens series.
Oh, wow.
And on the behind the scenes, Sigourney Weaver talks about being within earshot to hear the xenomorph in character with the earwig bit in his ear getting direction from David Fincher.
Okay.
And he is shouting the like most aggressive shit you could imagine. Yeah. Like, you hate that bitch. You're going to get her. There's nothing more you want in this life than to tear her down.
Yeah.
And she's like, I can hear you.
Right.
But it was to put him in the mindset.
Well, it's interesting, but it makes total sense because, you know, also when you watch a movie, you obviously don't think about that stuff. But when an actor's having to perform, you can't go like, act scared. Right. Like an actor cannot act scared, or generally it won't come across as being scared. And equally, sometimes they're not necessarily going to find a monster in front of them. It's actually scary, but like they need to be drawing from other things. So you create a kind of subtext with them to be able to push them. And you know, some of the stuff you end up talking or connecting or shouting about is nothing to do with what you're seeing on the screen.
I saw your short film, Butterfly, short animated film. And so animation is like at the other end of the spectrum in terms of, you know, and especially in stop motion, you're kind of literally hands-on.
Yeah.
I thought it must lend to an interesting sense of like timing and choreography. What's that like to go between those two mediums?
I mean, for me, it's sort of all part of the same journey, really, as in I never trained in animation, but I always loved seeing it, especially like I said, the sort of live action style, as in the sort of stop motion side of things. So it still feels very magical to me because you literally can see something coming to life in a way that, although I again love computer generated animation, it's already in a computer, it's already computerized somehow, so I still appreciate seeing real stop motion the most. And for me to do it, it was a sort of a learning curve, sort of self-taught experiment to tell a story which I had next to no money to do. I didn't feel like I could achieve something that visual that I'd be pleased with in a live action way, so I chose to do it stop motion. It took me 5 years. It was a real kind of intense, immersive experience.
Butterfly was 5 years in the making.
Wow. So it was 30 minutes long, took 5 years to make, and I was pretty much on my own for most of it, shut in a room with a camera, a 60mm film camera, no video assist for the first sort of couple of years. Wow. It was, you know, done through getting favors of friends to help and get lights, and I did involve a number of people, but it was predominantly sitting sculpting all the characters and creating the costumes, the puppets, the armatures, the sets. So it was really I was in this quest to make something that I could have to show people, to say this is kind of my kind of thing. Right. Film. And I eventually got into a film festival when I finished in Edinburgh, and that got me noticed in the music video people world. And so I started to make music videos, which I've thoroughly enjoyed, but it's always been, you know, the mission to make features. And so I used making music videos as a way of, you know, trying out storytelling techniques, effects techniques. My videos tend to be more narrative than a performance video. Good looking people, they're more weird and dark, and you know, I used them as a way of preparing to make The Hollow.
Cool.
Now, I see some of your drawings. Obviously, they're awesome, and I wish everyone could actually see them because it's really awesome. And I wondered, would there maybe be a comic book or something coming out on the horizon? Because it's beautiful artwork, you know. I wonder, are you a comic book guy? Is this something you would do?
I would definitely love comics, and I would love to do some sort of graphic novel with The Hollow. Maybe I've got an idea of some stories that would take place any time in the history leading up to The Hollow, of people who experienced in different time periods and, you know, an encounter with The Hollow. So and I have some ideas to create a kind of series of graphic novels and other ideas too, so it would definitely be something I'd be interested in.
Nice.
And I have
something to look forward to.
Yeah, right.
A recurring conversation we have is the So like the pumpkin head straw dogs, yeah. like mm-hmm. it's common in like closed communities.
Yeah.
When the locals tell you like beware yeah. of such as even like the Wicker Man.
Yeah.
When the locals tell you to like be on your toes, maybe leave, leave. Like always heed their advice.
I think we should listen to them.
Absolutely.
Yeah, in this case, yeah.
But then if you did, you would have a really boring movie where you'd have these creatures just sitting around being like, dude,
but
man,
I would be alive.
We've got to wait for another like year for someone else to talk.
Yeah, it's the Eddie Murphy joke about walking into the haunted house and it says, get out. Sorry, honey, we got to go. Tear exactly. up the mortgage papers.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally.
Okay, well, this was terrific. Corinne, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for sitting with us. I wish everyone could see this beautiful artwork, though.
I mean, it's because it's Fangoria. I'm pretty sure in the new Fangoria edition that I've provided some artwork and things as well. So I don't know if you'll link with that in the print version as well.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, thanks again. The Hallow opens on November 6th.
It's in theaters and then on VOD. Please try and go and see it in the movie theater because that's what it's all about. And it's only a limited release, but you can see it in New York and in LA and various places around the country.
Great. Go find it, people.
And on Twitter, it's Corinne Hardy and The Hallow UK if anyone's interested.
Great.
You've been listening to The Rance Macabre, a presentation of the Fangoria Podcast Network. Produced by Darren Rosario and Thomas DeFeo, and executive produced by Ken Hanley of Fangoria Entertainment. For press opportunities, advertising inquiries, and information about The Rance Macabre, contact Ken at fangoria.com.